Honorable Japal J. Harris now presiding.
Please be seated.
Good morning, Council. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'm Judge Japal Harris. We have three cases on our calendar today. Before we proceed, just a couple of housekeeping matters. On the podium, there is a button to adjust upward and downward to adjust to your comfort. The appellant will have 15 minutes, followed by the respondent, and then you will have a rebuttal. Please note that this matter is being recorded, and it will be released in the next day or two. Because of that, I will ask that at the beginning of each part of your arguments that you please note your name and your appearance for the record. With that, counsel, we are now calling court file A2413, 1137, Allison Baron Bonnet, petitioner, respondent, versus Theodore James Bonnet. And I will have the appellant begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Dennis Grand. My client was pro se when this case went to trial. He had a lawyer up until the time of trial, but he did not have a lawyer at trial, and he also did not move to have it continued. Afterwards, another law firm filed proposed findings. I did not file those proposed findings. I represent the husband, the appellant, the respondent in the lower court, the appellant. I represent him on the appellate brief.
So, counsel, you would agree that neither a previous attorney nor yourself filed any post-trial motions, whether it was to amend the findings or for a new trial, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And as such, as a preliminary matter, there are a number of issues I see here that it seems to me were never raised in front of the district court. Have those issues been waived? And if not, why not?
No, they haven't, Your Honor. if you read the transcript, I'm sure you did. All those issues were discussed by both the plaintiff and, or by both the appellant and the respondent. And so there was no post-trial motion. But on the other hand, there's no post-trial motion is necessary. If I may quote, Your Honor, from one of the cases cited by my opponent, Paulson versus Paulson, states the rule: while motions for amended findings are not necessary to preserve issues, if the court fails to make a finding on a particular issue, then it's necessary to make that.
What all about those, your Nardini argument about the eight factors from the IRS's revenue ruling 5960, those weren't specifically raised. And so in a non-precedential opinion, we previously have, our conclusion was that the Nardini factors argument wasn't properly before us. This is a case called Ordner v. Ordner. It's 2020 WL1242968. So I'm just wondering, why shouldn't we conclude that the challenge to the district court's decision about the closely held company?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
I said, why? Are the microphones on? I'm not. Can you hear me okay now, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Why shouldn't we conclude that the argument you raised about Nardini isn't properly before us? We previously concluded when someone hasn't raised that before the district court regarding the assets of a closely held corporation, in this case, Limpro and Northeast, that's waived or forfeited at least?
Because it was the valuation of those two companies was made by the expert witness, Mitch Hiley, who has who's been my witness in cases as often as counsel's cases, and Nardini, 59, Rev. Ruling 59-60, those are talked about all the time, and since there was no opposition, I don't know why it wasn't raised in trial, but certainly everybody was aware of Rev. Ruling 59-60 and Nardini. I can't tell you why.
Is there any authority that the district court had to make specific findings about Revenue Ruling 5960? Because Nardini itself just uses language that the court has to consider it. It doesn't compel the court to make findings about revenue. It must be taken into consideration before reasonable valuation can be made. And you know, requires consideration of all relevant factors. So why should we conclude that the district court abused its discretion when it doesn't seem like there's a specific command that district courts make express findings about the revenue ruling 5960 factors?
I don't know.
I mean, particularly because it wasn't argued, as you acknowledged. I mean, there was no opposition to the expert's valuation, right?
There was no opposition, no. And he was recognized as an expert. He's been my expert as often as he's been counsel's expert. So question was that, I mean, the issue was, do you just accept the purchase price as the value of the business? And you can't do that. What did Hiley do? He did that. Why? Because he had no opposition. There was no expert opposing him. If there had been, he would have had to do that. But he did an incomplete job. He should have raised something about Nardini or about the factors under 59-60.
The lawyer, in talking to Mr. Bonnet beforehand, I had to, he asked me many questions about being pro se, and I read the transcript, and I could recognize the anger and the rancor, right? It hopped right out on the words of the page. Nonetheless, I advised him that parties, whether they're represented by lawyers or not represented by lawyers, in other words, pro se, the legal system requires courts to fairly decide the issues without bias and favor, irrespective how difficult, indeed, in this case, insulting, regardless of how insulting, a self-represented litigant can make a trial. Or whatever mistakes he may make along the way. His biggest mistake was not filing timely his exhibits. That's a mistake that pro se litigants make often.
Can I ask you a question about the parenting time decision?
Sure.
So your counterpart makes an argument in her brief that the court didn't need to make findings. Didn't need to make these specific findings, if I understand it correctly, that you're arguing needed to be made under, it's 518.175 subdivision 1B, because subdivision 1G establishes a rebuttable presumption. If there's other evidence, the court can make a determination that parenting time should be less than 25%. It's just that 1B requires the court, if it makes an endangerment finding, to reduce it below 25% or to eliminate it altogether. So why shouldn't we conclude that that's what the court did here? I mean, 1G begins with the phrase, in the absence of other evidence, there is a rebuttable presumption. So, I mean, we can get to the court does use language about endangerment related to emotional health, but setting that aside, why shouldn't we determine that this is what your counterpart says it was, is simply a determination that there was sufficient evidence to rebut the presumption?
Well, what the court has to do is make findings about conduct, and then it has to tie the conduct to the ultimate decision. Was there endangerment? If there is endangerment, then there is reason to reduce.
Well, that's I think what respondent is arguing is that the endangerment requirement under subdivision 1B applies if the court finds after a hearing the parenting time with the parent is likely to endanger the child's mental, physical, emotional health, the court shall restrict parenting time. So that's if endangerment is the reason, then the court shall restrict parenting time. But if there is evidence that rebuts the presumption of 25% under 1G, then the court can make a parenting time decision that's less than 25%. And so do we even need to be concerned about the endangerment finding if your counterpart's reading of 1G is accurate? And is that an accurate reading of 1G?
I don't believe it is accurate. The salient facts regarding parenting are the fact that the parties lived together for 2.5 years while this was going on prior to the trial. They lived for 2.5 years together, joint, and the recommendation of the parenting consultant, the woman who was hired by the court to do the parenting evaluation, made a recommendation of almost 50-50 parenting time.
Just to your point about the fact that they'd been living under a different parenting time plan for a while before this order was in place, that was a temporary order.
Of course it was.
So the court didn't have, so how do we then view what, you know, how do we view, you know, the shift from a temporary to a permanent order here as any kind of, you know, material change? Isn't it just part of the process of the district court in establishing parenting time? They're necessarily going to put a temporary one in, but then apply subsection D or G, as Judge Eid has pointed out, in the first instance?
The bridge between the temporary order or the temporary parenting arrangement and the final decision that the court makes is the recommendation of the parenting time consultant. And in this case, the recommendation was it was going well enough to continue it.
But you would agree that the court's not bound to follow the recommendation, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, so where is the where are the findings here? In whether it's inadequate or clearly erroneous, such that we, from our appellate review standpoint, could find that it warrants reversal. Because if they're not required to, I'm just trying to understand what exactly in the order was clearly erroneous or otherwise inadequate.
The court failed to say he beats the kids or he keeps the kids up too late, or he does this with the kids, or he doesn't feed them, or he doesn't.
But counsel, you would agree that the court, in the best interest findings, made at least, as I see, 9 or so different findings regarding the behavior of dad, particularly that he undermines and degrades mom in front of the children, that he has weaponized the children and placed them in the middle of the conflict, that he has known for months with one child struggling with mental health issues and not providing therapy, that he has had issues with their school, which has caused consternation with the children, and that he has engaged in behavior that at least find that the court found to be excessive, dangerous, and stressful to young children, that being the height. Taking those best interest findings and coupling it with the finding of fact as it relates to the parenting time, and that's finding of fact 22 and 23, why is that, how is that an abuse of discretion? Where is there abuse of discretion in that number of findings, which directly go to the emotional health of the children?
There's no finding that there is endangerment to the children. What the decision says, it was the father's argumentative conduct was vented toward mother, school employees, the court, and its orders, not against the children.
The order says his conduct has negatively impacted the children's emotional health and development. And that tracks the language of the statute. Parenting time with the parent, if after a hearing the parenting time with the parent is likely to endanger the child's emotional health, is one of the categories. So
as a Court of Appeals judge, you have to review whether that was accurate. What is the conduct that was that led to the conclusion that it was that there was endangerment? Well, the court didn't find there is endangerment. The court merely said there may be endangerment, but and didn't explain what conduct could be endangering.
All right, counsel, I do see that your time is up. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Joni Moberg of the law firm Henschel Moberg, and I represent the respondent in this appeal, Allison Barron, who was formerly known as Allison Bonnet. As an initial matter, as some of you have already discussed, most of Mr. Bonnet's requests that he's raised on appeal should be denied on procedural grounds, having been precluded because he failed to offer witness testimony at trial other than his own. He failed to offer exhibits at trial, and I would note that I agree oftentimes district courts give latitude for pro se parties. Mr. Bonnet came to trial the morning of, and that's when he offered his exhibits for the first time. It was reasonable for the court in that instance to say none would be allowed, and it was only a single exhibit he was trying to offer. He also failed to make or preserve arguments for appeal, which he could have done in his post-trial findings or in at trial or by bringing a motion for amended findings. As it relates to the substantive issues, even if he isn't precluded from raising these issues on appeal, they should be denied on a substantive basis. You've discussed some about custody and parenting time. As you all know, the district court has incredibly broad discretion in the area of custody and parenting time, and that is because this district court judge had a chance to see the exhibits, receive the testimony, and judge the credibility of the witnesses firsthand. All of that supported the detailed findings that she made. As has been discussed as well, the district court is not required to adopt the opinions of experts. However, in this case, the judge did take the expert report into consideration. A lot of the findings and fact gathering that the expert had provided were helpful in this case. However, 7 months had passed between when the expert finished gathering information and when the expert, when trial happened, and in those 7 months.
Can I ask you about the parenting time issue? Because on that argument that you made about 518.175 subdivision 1G, it looks like the district court decided to restrict parenting time under 1B. I mean, the paragraph, it cites 1G in the paragraph 22 above, but it doesn't it read to you like this was an endangerment determination?
I agree it does read that way. It strikes me, Your Honor, as somewhat of a belt and suspenders approach. The district court was being extra cautious, but was overly cautious because the statutes shouldn't be conflated. There's one statute, one subsection of that statute that says there's a presumption of 25% parenting time, which you can overcome without an endangerment finding. And then there's another that says you shouldn't restrict parenting time unless there's been endangerment. Here, my client was asking for restriction. She was asking that there be either supervised parenting time or no parenting time. That would have been a restriction. But that's not what the court ordered. The court ordered 3 out of 14 overnights, which is 21% parenting time. That's 4 percentages less than the statutory presumption. I think it would be a stretch to say 4 percentage points less, one overnight less every 2 weeks, requires a finding of endangerment. And so the court's findings are more than enough to support the actual legal standard that needed to be applied.
Well, so to your colleague on the other side's point, the district court didn't say that his client's conduct endanger the children's emotional health. It said his conduct has negatively impacted the children's emotional health.
Correct. And it could be that my client could have chosen to appeal the ultimate lack of restricted parenting time and say that was inconsistent with the court, what the court did, but she chose not to do that. She's living with the court order, and it what the court actually did is more than supported by the findings that the judge made. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
I think so.
Okay. Certainly, the court's findings regarding parenting time were more than supported by the record. Judge Harris read some of those findings. There's 9 pages of them. Plus, there was the custody and parenting time evaluation, which actually does make some supporting findings about endangerment. There actually are concerns that the children are overtired when they're with dad, that they're overprogrammed when they're with dad, and that he engages in activities that are beyond their age limit and puts them in danger.
Some of that stuff, though, like taking the children on a, you know, the children are 7 and 8, right, or were at the time of the trial, taking them on a 5-mile hike, you know, the father going in and putting his gloved hand into the holy water. I mean, I can understand how people might disapprove about some of that stuff, but is that really endangerment?
I don't know. I think it's all things that are on the bubble. My point is that there were concerns that were raised. The larger issue, Your Honor, is that endangerment doesn't need to be found here to do what the district court did.
But the district court cited 1B in the paragraph in which the district court said it was restricting parenting time.
Like I said, I think that was overly cautious. She didn't need to do that to support what she did. I do think her findings are supported by the record, and it's not physical endangerment. The statute talks about endangering their emotional development as well. That was more the issue in this case. These children for 2 years had been caught in the highest conflict case I've ever experienced in my career, and I've been doing this for 25 years. It's extraordinary. And again, this is why I think it's important to defer to the district court judge. The school principal testified at trial and said she was frightened of Mr. Bonnet. She described this very strange behavior that day when he dipped his gloved hand as just walking into mass that was underway. The priest was up front leading mass, and Mr. Bonnet walked up the side across the front while the whole school was gathered and the priest was addressing the congregation. And he walked past the priest to interact with his kids, then turned around.
Give his child a kiss on the head.
He leaned across a teacher to give the child a kiss on the head. And then he walked out and put a gloved hand. It was strange behavior. And the principal said, I made eye contact with my staff because I was afraid we were going to have to do something. And remember, this followed on repeated admonitions where he'd been told, don't enter the school without coming to the office, and he found ways to get indoors and do that and show up in the teachers' rooms when they weren't expecting him and disrupt class. And that all came on the heels where he was repeatedly sending communications where he was lambasting Miss Barron to school staff and saying, I'm afraid of her, she's crazy. His behavior was a pattern of erratic behavior that was disruptive to the school and uncomfortable for the children. And again, that supports the findings that the court needed to make here, which is that it's in the best interest of the children to overcome the presumption of 25% parenting time.
Can I just to jump to the special master issue?
Yes.
And I'll stop asking questions. But I noticed in your brief that you said that Ms. Stahl is no longer employed with the special master's firm. That in the record anywhere?
It's not in the record. It's public knowledge. You could look it up on the website. I don't think
we can't decide
juice
based on stuff we look up on websites, right?
You can certainly disregard that fact. I can tell you as an officer of the court that she's not there. It's available information to the public right now. But even if it's not the case, the law that Mr. Grand cites when he's indicating she needs to be removed is the imputed conflict law, and that applies to lawyers, not paralegals. You can erect screens for paralegals, and that's appropriate ethically for you to continue your work. And then the canons of judicial conduct, to the extent that they apply to a special master, just saying this could have happened isn't enough. Mr. Bonnet would need to say it actually, something has happened, I'm concerned about it. But as a officer of the court, knowing her ethical obligations, Ms. Larson reached out to the district court and said, I've reviewed, I don't have a conflict, I'm completely sheltered from this staff person, we haven't talked about the case. I don't feel that I'm precluded from working on this, but I would like to make sure that you're comfortable with it too. And Judge Yellowhammer issued the order that she ordered, which was appropriate. I'll touch briefly on the issue of fees. The decision of attorney's fees rests almost entirely within the discretion of the district court, and the fee award should be affirmed here. Because again, Mr. Bonnet didn't bring any motions for amended findings, so to the extent that he felt that the findings in the court order were deficient, he needed to raise that and give the district court judge a chance to correct the issue, but he did not. So what we're left with is a record that does support what the court ultimately did, because the court made a short finding, but it does state, I reviewed all these things, and the things that she reviewed were detailed affidavits and fee statements from my office that covered 2 years of conduct, including multiple times during the case when the court had reserved the issue, and so the fee award was ultimately reasonable. Remembering that in those fee affidavits and in other places in the court order and in the court record, the court has noted that Mr. Bonnet was reluctant or failed to disclose assets during the case. As a result, a special master needed to be appointed to oversee the discovery process. He repeatedly made false claims of domestic abuse against Ms. Bonnet. He had significant co-parenting misconduct, including maligning and verbally abusing Ms. Bonnet.
sorry to interrupt. But you would agree that the court's order doesn't make a specific kind of conclusory or finding or saying that husband unreasonably added expense or time to justify the award.
I think that's in there. There's a paragraph that says she agrees. She's reviewed the pleadings that were filed. She agrees that fees are necessary, and the fees that were sought were conduct-based fees. And so I think that, again, because he failed to bring a motion for amended findings, you're not confined to the court order. My understanding is your standard of review is you look at the whole court record, and does the court record support what was done? And the answer to that question is it does.
Are there required findings that you have to make in a conduct-based?
Just that there's required findings for a need-based case. For a conduct-based case, you just need to find that the conduct unreasonably contributed to the length and cost of the proceeding, which...
So my question is, under Subdivision 1 for need-based of 518.14, it says provided it finds, and then it lists what the court needs to find. But I don't see similar language in Subdivision 1A. It just seems to be all discretionary. So I'm wondering... Is there a case or something that this would be supporting your opponent's view, but that says that there's magic language the court actually needs to put into the order about conduct-based fees.
I'm not aware of any such language, and again, I've been doing this for a while, and I think if there was magic language that was grounds for reversal on conduct-based fees, I would know about it. The only thing the court needs to determine is that there was conduct that unreasonably contributed to the length and the cost of the proceeding, which the court here did.
Could you address in the time you have left here the issue about the marital and non-marital property?
Sure.
Which it seems like, as I read the district court's order, it did identify certain portions of at least three accounts that had non-marital property. But then there seems to be a question about whether the court considered that as non-marital when it was when it ordered the equalization payment.
Sure. This is a very unusual case to have Mr. Bonnet arguing that someone else didn't do his job well enough. It is very clear under Minnesota law that when you make a non-marital claim, you have the burden of proving it. We could have just said, honestly, he's failed to make his claim. He hasn't even tried.
But the court found that, right? So, I mean, the finding is in the order that it was non-marital. So, you know, as far as we're concerned,
we could have argued there is no non-marital claim. Instead, what Ms. Bonnet did is say, well, that doesn't seem reasonable. That seems like an extreme result. He hasn't hired an expert. He hasn't made any claims, but we have to have something. I'll have my expert do the best that he can. But it wasn't her burden. So to the extent that there need to be findings under Nardini, Mr. Bonnet is the one that needed to make sure that the record was sufficient to allow the court to make those findings. He didn't.
I don't think Judge Bentley's asking about the Nardini findings about Limpro and the other company. I think she's asking about the accounts and the court's finding that the accounts were non-marital property and how that squares with the, I think it's the equalizer payment that was ultimately ordered. There's two figures in appellant's brief that show how that worked out, and it seems like the findings are in conflict with what the court ordered.
I think there's a few property issues, and I'm not sure I'm crystal clear on which ones we're talking about, but when it comes to, I agree that there are some findings that seem in conflict with the conclusions, but because Mr. Bonnet didn't file a motion for amended findings, what this court needs to do, I believe, is to say, does the record support the ultimate conclusion? Even if there was some conflicting findings, does the record support what the court did? And the answer to that is yes. What the court did was supported by the record and within the court's discretion. If Mr. Bonnet has concerns about some confusing and conflicting findings, it was his burden to then bring a motion for amended findings. Because he failed to do so, he's waived that argument.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors, for your attention and your assistance today.
The issue I want to talk about is the clear error on the part of the court. The court found that there were non-marital funds, $216,000 of non-marital funds. Might not be important to some people, it's important to Mr. Bonnet. Those $216,000, instead of reducing the amount of the equalizer, increased the amount of the equalizer. And so that there has to be a remand to deal with that issue.
So what's your response then to, I think your colleague has pointed out that your client didn't file a motion for amended findings. So if the findings relating to the equalization payment were wrong, you know, does the fact that he didn't file that motion preclude our review to the extent that the equalization payment otherwise is supported by the record?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. The cases are Antonsen versus Ekvall, Paulson versus Paulson. While motions for amended findings are not necessary to preserve the issues, if the court makes a finding on a particular issue of fact, a motion to file amended findings is necessary. Well, it's clear that if something were going to Well, there is no general statement that, gee, he was such a jerk, we're going to give him another we're going to give her an extra $216,000, or words to that effect. The court just made an error. They put it, instead of putting that $216,000 on his side, actually taking it completely off the balance sheet, they put it in and they made it a marital asset. That's an error. There's no question there. Four 529s were ignored totally and awarded to her. So, and what is typical, I've done it about as long, I've practiced law about as long as counsel has, except I'm 25 years older and practiced all that time. So I know a little bit about what happens, and with 529s, you typically take them off the balance sheet because they're typically for the kids. That wasn't done here. There's nothing in the record that says we'll put the 529, we'll keep the 529s off the balance sheet.
Did the 529s affect the equalizer payment?
Sure did.
And how did that work?
They're awarded to her.
Right, but with the specific provision in the order that she's simply to manage them for the benefit of the kids, she doesn't get the money. I mean, they're 529 accounts.
If you add all that up, the 529 is part of the 790,000.
Wouldn't that, she got full legal custody, is that right, in the dissolution?
She got sole.
She got sole legal, so wouldn't she get that anyway, with legal custody, the right to manage the 529s?
Probably, I don't know.
So then what difference does that make?
Well, it makes a difference to the total amount.
I mean, it didn't.
But counsel, if this money is not her money, it's the children's money, she is the individual who has legal custody for the children's education, I guess the question is, how does that amount that is not her money or his money factor into this equalizer payment? I'm failing to understand that.
It increases her equalizer by...
But how, counsel? It would increase her equalizer if it was her money. It's not her money. It's the children's. I'm truly baffled at what you are arguing this money is. Can you please tell me that? So how does it go into her column if it's not benefiting her, it's benefiting the children? You would agree a 529 plan is a plan in which you put money away for children to use later for educational purposes, which means she's not going to be able to use it for her own purposes.
That's not true. She, the owner of a 529, can use those funds for their own purposes. It doesn't have to be for the children. I mean, that's what it's meant for, but it doesn't have to be. Frequently, it isn't, and it's typically considered a marital asset unless both parties agree.
Counsel, can you point out any case in Minnesota, any case law that has even addressed whether or not a 529 account established for a children's benefit are treated as marital property?
I can't, as I sit here today. That's really a tax question. I'm not a tax lawyer, Your Honor. But
all right, thank you, Counselor. It seems that your time has expired. I'd like to thank both of you for your arguments. That was helpful for the court today. This matter is taken under advisement. We will issue an order in the statutory time frame. Thank you both.